Members of the Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee will now come to order. For the record, please remember to turn on your microphones for the roll call. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Lupus.
Here.
Vice Chair Coster.
Here.
Ranking Member Davis.
Here.
Representative Caruso.
Here.
Representative DeSegli.
Here.
Representative Duggan.
Here.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Honchofsky is excused. Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Learned.
Here.
Representative McCurdy is excused. Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Nixon.
Here.
Representative Roach.
Present.
Representative Rodriguez is excused. Representative Trabulsi.
Here.
Representative Trunow.
Here.
Representative Williams.
Here.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Kirsten. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Members, as always, please remember to silence all electronic devices and be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee or the presenters. Members, I'm super excited for this committee. It's something that we've been working on with staff for the last couple of weeks, and I think you're going to thoroughly enjoy it. We're going to have two portions. The first is going to be an overview of regulatory structure from the Department of Education, which will be followed by a panel of early learning providers from across the state. And in the interest of you can never have too much of a good thing, we're going to have Chancellor Mears come back for the second time to present to us, as I said, an overview of Florida's regulatory structure for early learning programs. Chancellor Mears, you are recognized. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lupus, Vice Chair Coster, and Ranking Member Davis. Thank you so much for the chance to give this high-level overview. At best here, this is the sort of the entree just to kind of whet your appetite for the panel, which is going to be the appetizer for the entree, the panel that's going to be the meat of what's happening on the field. And I, right when I came in as chancellor, one of the things we were working on was the legislature had appropriated the funds for the CERSA relief to be distributed, but it had to be through a budget amendment process to be implemented into a specific plan. And there was a work group into representing all different kind of interest groups in the sector that got together. We worked, we put the proposal, we got help from the legislature, from the Department of Education, from the governor's office, and the CERSA amendment that's what's called on consultation, which is essentially there's a 14-day period and the funds are available. And so I just want to say thank you to everyone. I know out the providers across the state are needing those funds, and the good news is on 10/28, the 28th of this month, those funds will be available and we'll be able to push that out through the grant process. So that's just a real exciting milestone for us. This is a quick overview of the regulatory structure that we're going to go through, and we could, of course, probably spend the whole time on any one of these topics. So this is going to be a high-level overview. And what I would say to you, if there any area that you have a particular interest in, or if you're going back over the slides, some of the detail things, and you just want to kind of talk about any particular part, I just would love to make myself available to you if there's anything you want to take a deep dive on. So this will be sort of the high-level overview. And just put a star by something that you need some more information on, and we'd be happy to take a closer look at any of that. So I'm going to move quickly. There's a lot of ground, but what we're trying to do is just to kind of give you some context, some lay of the land, so that when you hear from the different providers, you'll kind of have hopefully a framework that allows you to sort of organize that information you get from the providers. So, and this is something we covered last week, so I won't spend any time on it other than to say this is my dream job. I wake up every day excited because I love to be the Chancellor of Early Learning. And as I've, in my first month on the job, Chair Lupus said, if you don't, if you visit your Early Learning Coalition, visit providers in your area, I would just echo that, because the experiences that I've had in meeting the people that are in this early learning space, they are an incredibly wonderful group of people. The work they're doing from their hearts, their passion, their love. These are difference makers. These are great Floridians that we should honor. And as you get to know them, you can't help but falling in love. So it's going to be, as you have time to do that, it'll be a great experience. So there's two programs we're going to talk about, starting with voluntary pre-kindergarten. And the way I think about this, this is in the Florida Constitution. Florida has universal pre-K. It's an open door, but no one has to go through that door. So as a family, it's not compulsory, it's not required, but if you want it, it's available to you. And so this is a, there's two components, and a family can choose either one. They can do the school year program, which is 540 hours. And so if you think about a school year being 180 days, that's 3 hours a day over that traditional school year period. There's flexibility, so they can, you know, arrange and have slightly different hours, but that's just kind of the main layout for the school year program. The summer program is 300 instructional hours, and of course, they would take 100 days at 3 hours a day, and there's not 100 days in the summer, so that's going to be more than 3 hours a day over the summer. So this piece would be four-year-olds. It's in the Constitution, and when you think about where's the state funds are going, because this is a state program, it's primarily funded through the state dollars. So, in contrast, is going to be the school readiness, which is mostly federal funds. But the Florida VPK program is our universal early learning. And this is the program last week we talked about where Florida is taking a huge leap forward in quality, because now we're going to have the class assessment, which evaluates the program. It looks at the adult-child's interaction. And we're also going to have the progress monitoring. So when a child starts the program, let's say if it's the school year program at the beginning of the year, you take a snapshot, something there, mid-year, in-year, so we'll be able to see as students are progressing. And it's going to give us wonderful data that we've not had in the past. The school readiness program, this is the program that provides the early learning services for the low-income families. So you think about this as like the working poor. These are people who are getting up, they're out the door, they're going to work, but at the wage they're currently under, they're working in, it's below 150% of poverty. They can't afford the high-quality early learning. And so through the school readiness program, the state covers about, or the state with federal funding, but the program covers about 90% of their costs. So the federal recommendation is like that the family should use about 7% of their income. Florida is structured so the family is putting about 10% of their household income in a copay, and the rest is covered. And again, just in general, kind of broad numbers. And in terms of, again, as I like to think of context, with COVID, the VPK went down, and the kindergarten program was also down. That's not compulsory. So a lot of families, given all the uncertainty, kept some children at home that normally would have been included. But if you kind of back up before that, in 2019-20, there was 171,000 students in VPK. And so that would be primarily your four-year-olds. And then the school readiness, the number is 221,000 students in the school readiness. So if you think about those numbers, the VPK is just the four-year-olds. The school readiness actually starts at zero and goes through age 13. And a lot of people focus on the 0 to 5, and of course that is like the all-day early learning and care. But when a child gets into kindergarten, first, second grade, the school readiness program can provide aftercare, like care before school, after school. So a parent could drop a child off on the way to work and then have care before school or after school. And it also could cover over the summer, spring break, and that goes up to 13 years old. So all that is under the school readiness umbrella. So now, with kind of those two big programs, we'll kind of take a quick look at each one. So again, SR, in our world means school readiness and VPK. The provider types, you can see there's a whole list of different provider types, and many of those are just the same for the school year VPK and the summer VPK program. And so again, on these, I'm gonna go ahead and move through them rather quickly, but if there's one that you just are interested in, wanna learn more about, you can certainly ask me or flag it, and we can take a closer look to give you some additional background. So the minimum contract requirements for both school readiness and VPK, the way that a provider, and the provider is someone running an early learning center, they're providing the services, they're a private business that's providing the services, the way they serve VPK or school readiness children is through a contract. And we have a state, a uniform contract that the early learning coalitions enter into with the provider for these services. And so when you say minimum contract requirements, that's if you're a provider and you want to serve VPK students and or school readiness students, and of course you can serve both or one or the other, you do that by entering into a contract. And once again, the contract is lengthy and detailed. It covers a lot of ground, but here's some of the key minimum contract requirements. Note that for the first bullet there, the provider must provide instruction aligned with the Florida Early Learning Developmental Standards. That's, last week there was talk about the BEST standards. Those are standards for kindergarten through 12th grade. The standards that are used for school readiness, the 0 to 5 and VPK, are the Early Learning Developmental Standards. And the other, there's insurance requirements, there's the health safety requirements that are in place, and for school readiness, it's a requirement to collaborate with the Early Learning Coalition to conduct developmental screenings. That's required for school readiness. It's not specifically required for the VPK, but in many, many instances, those screenings still take place. It's just not a contract requirement. Some differences and similarities. The assessment piece, the child assessment is for VPK is going to be through the progress monitoring tool that's being procured and that will be implemented in the fall. What has been in place prior to that was the Flickers assessment, which was conducted by the public school when the student started kindergarten, but that is going to now take place in the VPK setting as a progress monitoring tool. The piece we talked about, and just to keep it clear in your mind, because I'm as someone new, the program assessment, again, isn't looking at how a particular child is doing, but is assessing the program, is the class assessment, and that's looking at the adult-child interaction in the classroom. So that's the quality of the setting and the attentiveness of the adults to the children. That class score has been in school readiness for years, and now through 419 is going to be a part of voluntary pre-K. So that is a massive step forward in terms of the quality and the data that we'll have on our VPK programs. And in terms of improvement plans, again, through these tools, if there's problems, the provider has to go on an improvement plan, and if they don't improve, then they can no longer contract with the state. The eligibility revocation, of course, just failing to comply with the contract, those kind of things. If there's the Department of Children and Families, if there's health safety violation, they would impose a class one or class two violations. And so, all those things can result in the revocation of the contract. Now, the next piece I'll look at is the credentials, the people providing the early learning instruction. For VPK, there's some some new things that we talked about last week, so I'm just going to quickly touch on those. The literacy, this is the director credential, the teacher director credential. For the VPK, for the school year program, you have to have the director has to have a child development associate. Now, that's not associate degree. That's a credential that's 120 hours of instruction plus like an apprenticeship supervised time at a center. So that is the credential for that. The summer VPK, the requirement is a bachelor's degree or higher. So for school year, it's a CDA. For the summer VPK, it's a bachelor's degree or higher. And the directors at a private VPK must have five-hour courses, and including the emergent literacy course, the mathematical thinking. And a new thing that was passed in 419 was the private school administrator that has a educational leadership certificate doesn't have to have a separate director credential. The VPK teacher training, this is what I jumped ahead. This is what I was talking about earlier. It used to be one 5-hour emergent literacy course. We now have three, so that is a huge step forward. Also, the 5 hours of training around the standards, and again, it's the Florida Early Learning and Developmental Standards. We want to be sure that all of our VPK instructors understand what those standards are, those developmental standards, and that they're fresh in their minds as they're implementing the instruction. For a licensed provider giving VPK instruction, these are the DCF requirements for the 40-hour of child care and training that must be completed within 1 year. The school readiness training and credentials, again, it's the DCF has the 40-hour course, but instead of having a year to complete that training, you have in school readiness 90 days, and there's also the annual in-service training that's associated with that too. Performance standards and requirements. This is again unpacking just a little bit the Florida Early Learning Developmental Standards, birth to kindergarten. Whether it's VPK or school readiness, they're teaching to and must have curriculum aligned with those standards. And so the good news is that now we have the progress monitoring. It will be aligned to those standards, and we'll be able to assess and evaluate how students are progressing as they're developing those skills and progressing in towards kindergarten readiness. This we pretty much covered last time, but it's just for reference. I think the thing I wanted to highlight was we're headed towards a transition. And it's a very good transition, but still transitions in a big system take a lot of time and preparation to sort of get everyone used to something new. We have about 12,000 VPK classrooms. And so in those classrooms, there's going to be the class program assessment that looks at, again, the adult-child interactions and also the progress monitoring. And that is something we're intently focused on to have a smooth transition, because all that is going to start in less than a year. It'll start in the fall of 2022. And Division of Early Learning is working with all stakeholders to be sure that we use this time now to ramp up so that everyone's really ready to lean in. And on day one, it's like a restaurant in your grand opening. If you need to have a soft opening, fine, because when you get to the real grand opening, you want to be really ready for prime time. And so that's our effort. And we're working hard to be sure ready to open fire and out in all cylinders when those new changes are in place. In terms of the assessment accountability, again, I would just say point out that we're raising the bar. Right now, the minimum class score to contract is 3.5, but for 22-23, that's going to 4.0. And we're not just saying, hey, you know, do this. We're recognizing with differential pay those that do better. So as you get to the minimum contracting score, if you go above and beyond that, there's additional resources available for that. And so that's going to be it's just a great thing for the system. It's helping the adults to focus on the things that make the biggest difference for the children. And so with that, again, I want to be sure the panel has plenty of time, but I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chancellor. Members, any questions? Representative Duggan? Oh, Representative Learned, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Mears. Always good to see you again. I was hoping we can go back to slide 7 real quick. I think this is a fairly basic question, but the difference between the VPK instructional staff, they're required to have the director credential, and then the VPK summer program, they need the bachelor's degree. Do you need a bachelor's degree to have a director's credential?
You do not. So the school year bar, I guess, in terms of the time it would take to get the credential is lower. The director's credential is 120 hours plus, I think it's like 300 hours of sort of an apprenticeship or supervised work at a center. So it can often be done, I think, in like six months or something to get your CDA.
Follow, Mr. Chair?
Recognize.
I guess I'm just curious then why, if the content of the instruction is the same, why do we require a higher degree of education for a shorter program that's exclusive to just the summer months?
You recognize.
That's the you know, what the current statute requires, but that may be something to look at to see how they should be aligned, whether it should be both aligned at the CDA level or both the bachelor's. The difference in the day-to-day, the summer program is going to have more than 3 hours right. in a day, so it's going to be more concentrated versus just 3 hours a day. But as you said, it's the same standards, the same program. The children are essentially, you know, the same age. So I do think that having a uniform credential would be good requirement.
Recognize.
Thank you for that, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Unrelated question on the next slide. You talk about the pre and post assessment for VPKs. You know, I have some young kids that come to my tutoring center, and I know on the first day it's relatively easy to do an academic assessment of a kid, but since at the VPK level, a lot of this is social skills, and we talked about this last week in committee, where, you know, what that future VPK assessment will look like. So I guess my question is, like, how do you do a pre-assessment on social skills? Like, you might not know that kid is prone to temper tantrums on the first day. You learn it pretty quick, though, if you're in one of these centers.
Yes, there's surprises. So the pre and post assessment and then the progress monitoring, it will be limited to the things that sort of an iPad can find out about a kid. So I think for some of those other developmental components, like the executive function, the time on task, works independently, necessarily, as we go forward, we're going to have to, as a system, be sure there's tools to evaluate and track that. So the academic skills and knowledge, like, you know, knowing the letters or the sounds or some of those things, or the, you know, pre-math skill, pre-literacy, but the developmental piece, not all of that is going to be able to be captured by a progress monitoring tool, because the tool, as it's set out in statute, is a computer adaptive assistive tool, and so we're limited to the things that our, you know, psychometricians have determined we can assess with that kind of a tool. And what you're talking about, I think, is you would need some type of an observational tool where the teacher is able to measure and evaluate, or an evaluator, time on task, or some of the behavior developmental things. How long can they, you know, can they follow directions, and can they, you know, interact with others?
Representative Hawkins, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the eligibility of the programs and talk a little bit about the improvement plans. Is that kind of a generic improvement plan, or will it be individually based on each program? And well, is there a time in place they have to improve, or if you see improvement, just if you can elaborate on that.
You're recognized.
Okay. Well, and I, twofold. First, I can follow up with you to get some more specific information on the improvement plans. It's not a generic, it would be tailored specifically to the school. And when it's a class score that is below the contracting threshold, or they've fallen below, they have two things. There's courses that are available that specifically that the center will then have in their improvement plan that actually help them address the issues. And we've seen those work very, very well. And the provider then can get reassessed and see that their class score has gone up. So absolutely, there is there's an expectation that they will do the training and improve. But beyond that, I will need to get more information as far as exact timeframes.
Vice Chair Koster.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you so much again for being here. I was curious with respect, I think it's like slides 9 through 11, with respect to the DCF's health and health and safety training and education and credentialing. Do you know whether there's anything included in that health and safety regarding infant mental health or mental health for these young children?
So I don't know. DCF, you know, administers that, and what I can do is get with Wei, our amazing colleague over at DCF, and get like a topical list of, and I'll provide that to you, and also provide it to the chair in case that's something he wants to share with the rest of the group. So you can kind of see what's covered in that 40 hours of training. It is required, and sort of boots on the ground, every new early learning employee working in this space is going to have that training, so to look at what's covered.
So, Chancellor, if you get that to us, we'll make sure the entire committee receives it. Ranking Member Davis with a question.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chancellor. On the slide 13, you talked about transitions for the fall 2022. Excuse me. Are you anticipating any shortfalls, possibly in staffing, when you begin to transition in these centers, along the lines of the incentive and differential pay that you mentioned? And I think that was on slide 14.
You're recognized.
So if I may, Chair, are you talking about the staff to like administer the class score? Because we need now 12,000 new classrooms to be evaluated, or the staffing at the center itself?
Maybe the staffing at the center itself, with the transitioning, now they have to take the in-services and things like that. And you mentioned the differential pay for, on slide 14, for the program assessment and the child assessment. Who is that differential pay for? And at the end of that statement, it said, is available. So is that something that's on a temporary basis? Is that something that will be awarded to the staff as they take the training?
You're recognized. Right.
Thank you, Chair. So on the differential pay, that is available and spelled out through current rules or rules that so that's for the school readiness program. Those incentives are available, and it goes to the center in the form of additional pay. For the here's the good news on that front for the cost. There, as you'll hear from this panel, I'm sure there are some very important workforce issues in terms of as Florida is surging and there's a huge demand for workers, wages are going up also because of the minimum wage. That's creating a lot of competition. And so the people, frontline early learning professionals, have many options in the workforce. And we're working very hard to make working in an early learning center as attractive and inviting as possible to create, you know, to keep those people here. One thing that is coming that we're working on, like as our top priority, is developing plans for the ARPA funds to be released, and that's the stabilization component of that for Florida is approximately $1.4 billion. And so those funds are available, and once our plan is approved, those funds will go to providers, not just providers that are participating in these programs, the School Readiness and VPK, also to private pay providers, like all providers across the state will be able to access those funds, and they will receive them between when they start, which is likely like this January, all the way through 2022, all the way to September of 2023. So that's going to provide, that's like on top of everything we're doing, those are additional resources to stabilize, to help with all the needs that a provider may have. So I think on the short run, that is going to be a huge boost to providers who are struggling to maintain their workforce, to recruit in a really competitive environment. And also, out of the, as I talked about before, we're planning to create incentives and rewards so that when a teacher does complete the 5-hour literacy class, we're able to reward them so they're not having to take extra time that's not compensated. We want to be able to have a completion benefit that would go to the employee for successfully completing. So, yes, there is some extra, it's a higher bar. You have to have additional training, but I think with the resources that are planned, the resources that are planned actually more than make up for the raised bar. So I believe that the providers are going to have the tools they need to be able to be successful as we transition with these new requirements.
You recognize.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chancellor, for that answer. I'm going to take you in a different direction because this is great, and we all are very supportive of what you all are doing here through 419. The question is, we've concentrated right now on the emergence literacy. We know there are emergent math courses that we have throughout the country. And so my question to you, and this is a thought process, is for us to start introducing our children, our younger students, to the engineering, the scientists, the maths around and directing them in that area. When or how do we begin to focus on math and introduce math to our younger children so we're producing more engineers, scientists that have been exposed to numbers just like we're doing here in 419 to expose them to literacy?
You recognize.
Thank you, Chair. And as you're talking, my heart is really singing because I agree. We want to set up children for success and the math skills are vital. And there are, in this space, courses, of course, available in the emergent mathematics. And I was going to mention from slide 9 that for a director of a private preschool program, they all have not just the emergent literacy, but also the mathematical thinking, which is kind of the emergent math. But I agree with you 100% that as we're providing training for our young learners, exposing them to those STEM concepts so that they grow up, you think of children that they, you know, love science and they love nature and they love animals, being sure that we're visualizing those incredible futures for our young learners, regardless of, you know, what zip code they're in. We're saying you would be a great scientist and you're good with numbers, and we begin to believe in them so they can believe in themselves, and we show them people with, you know, that they can identify with who are great mathematicians, scientists. So I think that's really important. I'd love to work with you, and as we brainstorm with our providers around the state, like make sure our teachers have that training, not just the emergent literacy, but the STEM fields as well.
All right, Member. Chancellor Mears, thank you so much again for being with us.
Thank you, Chair. My pleasure.
All right, members, we're now moving into the second part of our meeting. And before we start, I just want to say, you know how excited I get about this issue. I'm so grateful to the four people you have sitting in front of you because several of them traveled very far to be here today. I've always thought about this issue as the workforce of tomorrow. So I don't think I'm being hyperbolic when I say that the individuals you see in front of you are sort of the guardians of Florida's future. And I say that because the children that are in their centers right now are going to be the workforce of 2040. It's a fact. But what the pandemic showed me is that they're also the guardians of Florida today, because without these providers, we cannot continue to keep our economy going. People cannot go to work. And one of the things that we saw through the pandemic, and in my community in particular, we saw 85% of the child care centers close. And you can understand the rippling effects that that has on mothers and fathers who need a safe, healthy, educational place for their children to be during the day. And the legislature and the Department of Education took tremendous steps to try and do everything they could to alleviate those pains by, you know, changing the reimbursement rates from attendance to enrollment, understanding that there were going to be children who were not going to be in school. We focused on first responder care, making sure that first responders had full access to whatever available care there was in their community so that they could be on the front lines fighting COVID. But there are still very real challenges. And we get to hear a lot of presentations. And my goal today is I want everyone on this committee to hear from the mouths of the people who are fighting on the front lines of the early childhood battle to make sure that these centers remain open and that they can continue to serve the children and the families that they have served for decades. And I know the challenges that you have faced. I'll say two things that I think are important for the context of this conversation. I am not Randy Fine. This is not the Appropriations Committee. So clearly there are challenges there are conversations around funding that are going to be had, I imagine, at some point. But this is the Policy Committee. So understanding the regulatory structure, what Chancellor Mears has talked about, you know, what we've done through COVID, how that has impacted the early childhood industry. And secondly, there is no silver bullet policy that's going to fix this. There's no silver bullet policy that's going to ensure that all of our early learning providers are able to come out of COVID in the same way that they were operating pre-COVID. This is going to be comprehensive, it's going to be complex, and you're going to hear from all four of them. There are challenges that they are facing today, and there are going to be challenges that they face tomorrow and in the years to come. So my hope is that we get to hear from all of them. They represent a geographic spread of our state. They come from different accrediting bodies. They imagine they have different pedagogical approaches. But at the end of the day, the one thing that holds them all together is that they are the guardians of Florida's future. So that's why I'm so excited to have all four of you. So we have from the 305 from Miami, Shauna Poinfil, who is the owner of Excel Kids Academy. He drove the furthest from Tallahassee, Roy Keister of Scottsdale Academy. Thank you for your sacrifice, Roy, for driving so far. We have Gene Hitchcock from Along the Way Early Education in Marianna. And we have Lindsay Carson, a good friend for a long time, who is the CEO of the Early Learning Coalition of Pinellas County. And what I would like is, we'll start with you, Ms. Poinfil. I'd like for each of you to provide 3 to 5 minutes of opening remarks about what you're experiencing, the challenges that you're facing, and then once we go through the panel, we can open it up to discussion. So, Mrs. Poinfil, you're recognized.
Greetings, everyone. I'm Shauna Poinfil from Excel Kids Academy in Miami Gardens, Florida, about one block away from Hard Rock Stadium. It's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to share what's going on the front line and my day-to-day struggles with operations, regulations, and providing the high-quality expectations set by your committees. There's little to no employability interest in early education. However, there are many people that are willing to do the work, that love the work, and that are passionate about showing up daily to serve our children in childcare programs. The teacher registry, it would be a great help to improve and collaborate the training and violations and education of the workforce that are employable and willing to show up. The penalties that they may cause on our accredited five-star rated programs they don't receive consequences from those actions. The school receives the consequences when a teacher abuses a child on site or mishandles policy or regulations. The school receives those class one violations, and that's a horrible impact on a director and owner that's showing up daily providing exceptional services. So we need workforce that are excited about showing up and is in a sustainable position to deliver the expectation. Through our attendance, when we submit attendance for our food programs, we're able to kind of budget ourselves and identify how we could manage our spending and our operations from the roof to the back fence. I mean, making sure that we meet the expectations. So our reports and data entry systems would be improved if we're able to calculate how much we're going to be reimbursed for providing the service. We could budget ourselves and maintain programming more effectively if we had the numbers. I mean, if we knew what our day-to-day, month-to-month numbers are going to be. Supports for students with special needs. When parents enrolled through the the enrollment process for school readiness and VPK, we don't know that a child has autism. We don't know that a child has developmental delays that would cause them to be low performers. We accept every student that comes through the door with the expectation that we could meet their needs. Some of my teachers and staff members are 19-year-old, fresh from high school. They completed the DCF requirements, but they aren't trained and aware of how to meet the needs of students with autism. So you have an epileptic student, a student with autism, and maybe 9 typically developing students. A teacher goes on lunch break and never shows back up. It's impossible for the workforce that we're able to capture to deliver to that demographics, to those students. And then the school is penalized because that 19-year-old or 65-year-old who still shows up, loves children, will roll on the floor all day. There's specific professional and educational work required to deliver to a student, to students with special needs. And we try the early steps and we use the, child fine. We fill out the forms and we stand by and wait and hope that someone's going to show up to support us. And the help doesn't arrive, and there's no note on our VPK assessments to mark off if that student has a delay or a disability that may have caused them to perform under expectations. The onboarding process is a challenge because everyone that comes through the door prior to us hiring, we have to be sure that their background screen have first aid, CPR, and meet the DCF minimum requirements. With the turnover that's going on and the way that we're able to capture quality staff, it's definitely a challenge and an expense to background screen every single person that walks through our door that we hope would clear in order for us to fill the space and serve. It is required to meet ratio. You know, we have a ratio requirement through DCF. So we may have the students and a wait list and parents that want services, but without the staff, qualifying staff, we can't enroll those students. So the wait list grows, but there's no staff to meet the wait list demands. And we're standing by with a budget, operational responsibility, regulations, and policies that hinder us from moving forward within the guidelines. So it's, we need to keep the mortgage paid, but we don't have a teacher in order to fill up the classroom. So we're working a full, huge 18 by 20 classroom with one teacher at minimum enrollment because we have to hire another staff member in order to increase the classroom capacity. So I appreciate the opportunity for you to hear me out, and I apologize that I'm a bit nervous. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I am available, and I'd love for you to follow and keep watch on the work, because the work works. When we show up, the work works. Where our doors are open, and not only does the programming support the children, it also develops the families, because the comprehensive, holistic approach to the entire community being a part of the early education industry, where we're building for sustainable contributors to society. I come from a background of law enforcement, where I worked in state prison, Florida State Prison, and Miami-Dade County Correctional Institution, and I was well taken care of financially, keeping our community behind bars. So the transitioning from law enforcement and the prison system to early education, a more preventive, healthy for myself and my family industry, but financially it was just a struggle. And but it's a passion project, and I'm rewarded for the opportunity to be able to serve, but I would like for the supports and the infrastructure to be, if not exceeding what's available in the prison system for inmates, to be available for infants and toddlers and preschoolers and elementary school students that are gonna be our future, our workforce. They're gonna be our nurses one day. You know, our doctors, they're going to be taking care of us eventually, and we want them to be the best in the best position to give us what we need when they're taking care of us, once an adult, twice a child. So we will see these children in the alleys, in the offices, in the back ways, and we want to. My goal for Excel and all of our goals is to be sure that they're in position to be great citizens, productive people, in mind, body, soul, spirit, and academics.
Thank you, Ms. Boyle. Just Ms. Boyle, I should have said this before. Could you just give really quickly, sort of the you know, if you're doing both SR, VPK, sort of the makeup of your center, just so we can sort of see
certainly
how each operator is providing.
Certainly, here. Excel is 93% school readiness. VPK, we have about 7% private pay. All of our students are subsidized for the most part, and our families are low income.
Thank you, Ms. Poynville. Mr. Keister, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members, for allowing me to share my story with you guys today. Like Shauna said, the work that everybody up here is doing is very, very important work to the success of our state and our country, as the chair has said in the beginning. You know, a little bit, I'd like to tell you a little bit of story on how my wife and I got where we were at. We are both business people who work for big companies. We weren't raising our kids when we started having our family, and when our parents were raising them. And when we started looking for childcare, it was scary. It was real scary. So we looked at each other and said, we can do it better. We ended up starting, going on 18 years now. We have two locations, serve over 300 families, have 65 employees. And when we decided to leave our very successful corporate world to do childcare, our friends and family thought we lost our mind. But, you know, the story behind it, we have three beautiful daughters. Two are now in college. One is a freshman in high school. And I always say it's the corny saying, but we want to leave this place better than we found it. And a strong foundation with children is the only way we can do it. Because just like the chair said, 40 years from now, one of our students is going to be sitting there, and one of our students is going to be sitting right here. So if we don't do it right, we failed. So kind of going into our current struggles, you know, Shauna kind of talked about it. I think one of the biggest struggles today is we are in a teacher crisis. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that every company in the world today is looking for good employees. The challenging part for us is as wages increase and as quality, looking for quality workforce people increase, those challenges are, they're much, much bigger, because now people have more choices. And choices are great, but as those things happen, you know, we have to decide how we balance that out, because there's different ways. There's funding from the state, whether it's state or federal government, it's private pay families increasing their costs. But when we do those things, all we're doing is increasing the cost of Florida families when childcare is already very, very expensive. So, you know, how do we balance those things out? For teachers, some of the things that we're seeing is, you know, the quality of candidates we're seeing today is much less. We can set up 15, 20 interviews in a week. We're lucky if two or three show up. You know, the other things that we're trying, and this, like you said, is a policy committee, challenges that we're facing are as when we're lucky enough to find a candidate, and that candidate, before they can even work for us, has to pay that background screen. Before day one, they're already having to have money come out of their pocket to come work for us, when in other jobs, they don't have to pay that as an upfront cost. The other piece is there with level two background screening. When we went to level two, it's been multi-years ago, the state had made a commitment that they would turn around those background screenings in 48 hours. I'm here to tell you today, we're at now 2 to 3 weeks, and not for a level two background screen, but for a rescreen. This is somebody that's already has their fingerprints in the system, and it is taking 2 to 3 weeks. So we're sitting here saying, okay, well, we have students that we can have in our class that we found a candidate that we like, but we can't bring them on board because we got to wait 2 to 3 weeks for the state to tell us, okay, they're okay to come work for us. The other thing is the training. Chancellor Mears talked about training. Training is very important, but those trainings also cost money to those staff members. We've got to figure out ways, especially when a lot of this training's online. And yes, University of Florida has training that is completely free to get your 90 days of in-service training, but the other 40 hours is still a requirement of DCF that they have to do. So if they do the free University of Florida training to make the 90-day service requirement, then they still have to do the other training, so they're almost doing double the work, which is going to take longer. The other thing is cash flow crisis. This is really created because of the global pandemic. You know, in the beginning, we had a lot of families that were scared to send their kids to school, rightfully so. We're at a stage today which, you know, the glass is half full. Parents want to go back to work. They have to go back to work. They have no more leave time. They want their kids in school. The challenges are there's inconsistency in quarantining periods across the state of Florida. Every local health department has their own guidelines. We're not consistent. The other thing is with testing. Rapid testing is about 50-50 accurate. So we have parents very frustrated when they are having quarantining their kids, and then they find out 2 to 4 days later that when the parent also did the PCR, the kid was actually negative. So it was a false positive. Those are frustrating parents, rightfully so. Those parents are now asking providers, they want their money back. They want refunds. Well, as Shauna said, we still have staff to pay. We still have mortgages to pay. We're sympathetic to that, but we're also trying to keep our doors open so people can go to work. The last thing that I'll say is, you know, I call it a lingering problem, is still trying to remind DOE that we are private sector businesses and the free market does work. You know, math, reading, all that stuff is really, really important. But to build a very, very strong foundation, you need social emotional learning. Without social-emotional learning, that child, when they enter kindergarten, can't sit still, don't know how to regulate their emotions. So social-emotional is the most important piece of early learning to allow for success in K through 12. The last thing I'll say is just I'd like for the members to kind of take this at heart. For what we all do, at our core, we're here to allow parents to be able to go to work. and know that their child is in a safe, caring environment. On top of that, then we can add the social-emotional learning, which leads to a successful foundation for K-12. I'll kind of end with, you know, when Jennifer and I started this 18 years ago, we kind of did our roadmap, and like, what's our roadmap to success look like? Obviously, children growing up, and to see kids that we have now in college is just such an amazing feeling, an amazing feeling. And our true core principles were, listen, this is childcare. We are caring for people most prized possession, their children. And we take that very, very seriously. Our core principles were, we're a business, and if we're not a successful business, we won't be here to serve those families. And the second thing was, we're going to run our business from a parent perspective. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Keister. Really quickly before we move on, could you tell the committee just sort of the makeup of your center, as if it's you have SR students, VPK, et cetera?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we do private pay, school raise, and VPK. Our makeup is roughly 85% of our students are private pay. The other 15% is school readiness. And the VPK makeup is roughly 60% private pay, 40% are the three-hour program.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Hitchcock, you're recognized.
Good afternoon. My name is Jean Hitchcock from Along the Way Early Education in Marianna, Florida. I'm very honored to be have asked to come talk with y'all. You can tell I'm a little nervous. I can talk in front of four-year-olds all day long. It's a little different. The makeup of our center is birth through school age, and we are about 65% school readiness, 35% private pay. In our VPK class, there are 20 students. 18 of those 20 are VPK. We have been in business since 1987. I started off in child care 40 years ago in a bowling alley taking care of Tuesday night leagues. I found out that as an artist, I could teach kids things. And when they learned it, I was like, wow, that's really, ooh, that's great. I want to do this again. So in 1980, I worked in a child care center in Daytona under United Way, a Montessori center, and it was amazing that children all developed very similarly. I was fascinated by the development of the human brain. And my father added on to it, he has a PhD in human factors engineering, and it's how things in the world affect the human, the brain. So when I would watch children draw the big-headed person, I was fascinated because that big-headed person is drawn by every child all over the world. It doesn't matter where they're at. That means it's developmental. So I knew at an early time I wanted to be the one to bring these children to where they needed to be. So in 1985, we moved to Marianna. We had a one-year-old. I was excited. I was going to find a job in childcare. And when I did, I was sad because it wasn't what I thought, and it wasn't what I wanted for my first child. So I spoke to my father, and he said, well, do you think you can open your own? Sure. So 1987, with one child, I opened, and I've grown, and I've been there all this time. And I'm now keeping kids of the kids I kept. And I know that we make a difference in their lives. I have two of my teachers are children I kept. Luckily, they weren't the ones in timeout. So, you know, you remember those things. And we are the guardians of these children. And when you look at them 20 years ago, it's not the same families. Even 5 years ago, it's not the same families. It's not the same children. I am referring more children for mental health services now than ever in my 40 years of doing this. And more staff. I have 30% of my staff are taking advantage of the mental health services being offered by our Early Learning Coalition. And my daughter, who I raised, we have three children, raised all through my center. My daughter runs a center across the street from mine, and 50% of her staff are taking advantage of the free mental health, because not only are we in a unique position having gone through Hurricane Michael and rebuilding from that and losing staff that had to move away because they lost everything, it's really been a challenge. So we are now back on top of trying to get past Hurricane Michael, and COVID comes and it shut everyone down. And it's a scary thing. And it wasn't scary just for the kids, but for the families, for my teachers, for ourselves. We didn't know how long this would last. We knew that this was going to impact our families. Our coalition was right there to answer any questions we had, to help us get through these tough places. But the toughest one was, how do we reopen safely? How do we do this with no vaccine at the time? Parents have my number. They were calling me at home, please, please open back up. I'm going to lose my house. I'm going to lose my job. I have to go to work. I'm a single parent. You can almost track society by using my classrooms. In the infant class, pretty much all have two parents in the home. By the two-year-old's class, we're at 70% are two parents. By the time they're in our preschool class, over 50% are now single parents. So we're watching families divide and separate as the years go by. And we want to be able to provide a stable environment. And we knew that we were probably the most stable thing in the children in our county who have moved and watched things fly. And every time it rains, I have children hiding. We're still dealing with some of that. And the COVID, when a three-year-old comes back to school and says, I don't want to die. You're like, oh, well, we have to talk. Now we have problems. I never had children asking me that. They weren't worried about that. They wanted to know which tricycle they could get first. It's a different time. And the type people to help these families are dedicated teachers. And both of these wonderful people spoke, it's almost like they had my notes. And we are facing that crisis of staff. We are facing the recruiting ability and the background screening, which I'm totally for. It's a passion. You can love children all day long. It doesn't mean that you can do this job. It's not what it was years ago. It's very, very different. And we're not only tending to the needs of the children, but the needs of the family, where they're saying, hey, do you know anywhere I can go? I need help. The rent is sky high now in our area because of lack of housing. It's amazing how few families are barely able to afford the rent in our area now. It's doubled and tripled. We need sustainability. We're going to hang on as long as we can, but not at the price of quality. We have to be there with quality. Instead of 11 two-year-olds, I keep 7 to a teacher because I know that's going to make a difference. And that teacher is dedicated to them. And the ones I have been there for 20 years. But getting the new ones in, that's hard. Because like you said, they're 19-year-olds that, oh, well, I have to do this and this. And, where is this going to take me in 5 years? And where we always promote education and teach scholarships and, the higher the education, the more money, of course, is expected. Knowledge is power. We want everyone empowered. And so there has to be incentives. And we try to find what we can. We're open for any ideas on that. But there are people out there, men and women, that will be excellent in this field. One, if maybe in the high schools, we show what early learning and early education can do. If we can get to them before they're out of high school and saying, okay, I'm going looking for a job, maybe give them an idea of what could be an absolutely amazing field. I'm doing what I love. I go every day, sometimes 11 hours a day. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Because when I look around at 20 kids in a classroom, and statistics show that one, and this was 20 years ago statistics, one of these 20 will end up in prison, and one of these 20 will end up in a mental institution. And I look at them and I say, not from here. And I imagine the numbers are much higher now. So we have to be what's stable for them. We have to be there. And I love the math and science part. I'm a real hands-on, your kid's going to get dirty here. They're going to get paint and everything. Think outside the box. As an artist, we will never see another Da Vinci or Picasso or great person unless we allow them to create and think outside the box. It's not all about this. And I tell my VPK parents when we do the conferences, every child will show growth here. And don't worry if they're not the highest point. Because if your child is Einstein and amazing IQ, but can't get along to Johnny next to him, he will fail. But if Susie, who barely passes, is a people person, she will be successful. So we have to make sure that the social and emotional part is there, and the science and the math. And that means blocks, and that means play. They don't learn through a computer. They don't learn through a Ditto sheet. They learn by touching it, by smelling it. The more senses we involve, the more they learn. And we want to continue doing what we're doing. We want to make a difference. And we know that the class is an excellent tool. And we know that there has to be an accountability. But I agree with, when you have one bad apple, it can ruin your business. And especially if they broke policy. If they broke policy and you're like, oh, and it's on your license and it's on your record. So those kind of things, we want to really see success. We are now in a position that we know that the children that have been with us the longest, when they hit VPK, their scores are higher. The children that just came to us for that class are lower. So we know that early education makes a difference. And I thank you for anything that you can do to help us keep going.
Thank you, Mrs. Hitchcock. I wish I'd gotten to your center because I'm not particularly good at time management. We have 25 minutes left. So, Ms. Carson, I'm asking if you could keep it between 3 and 4 minutes because I know the committee is going to have a lot of questions. But members, as I said, Lindsay Carson is the director of the ELC of Pinellas County, and I wanted you to hear her perspective from the coalition.
Thank you, Chair. I will try to be brief. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you. I've had the pleasure of actually taking Vice Chair Koster to a preschool. As an early learning coalition, we do have a slightly different perspective. I will not repeat all the insights shared with you today by our providers who are here, but let me just share a little bit about what we're seeing from the coalition perspective. First, we are serving a dual mission. We need parents to be able to work. I think that's pretty obvious. And we want our children to have a solid academic foundation. But in the end, we're also supporting the entire community. Working families in Pinellas County right now that are participating in the school readiness program, over a third of them are working in healthcare and social services. When they don't have access to care, that's impacting our entire community. Another 15% are in retail, 10% in hospitality and tourism. All of these fill into both essential workers and, frankly, our tax base. So when COVID hit, what we saw was that providers persevered. Things shut down, schools closed, and our preschools reopened pretty quickly. They were unsung heroes through much of the pandemic and continued to be tenacious and keep the work going in order to serve our families. What we're seeing now is demand is increasing again. Enrollment was low for a while. It's back. We have empty classrooms with no teacher to put in them and families waiting. In the school readiness program, we have families who have funding available, scholarships available, but are unable to enroll because there's not a place to take their child that they feel comfortable with, or not a place at all, particularly for infants, toddlers, two-year-olds, our younger population that is more expensive, less profitable. It's really difficult for them to find care. There's a lot of conversation right now about the great resignation and folks not coming back to work, particularly among women. And when you're facing a decision about staying home with a child, or going to work and putting your entire income just about into the cost of childcare, or not comfortable with the environment, it can be really difficult to make that decision to go back to work, again, impacting every industry across the board. Right now, 16% of providers in Pinellas County are at risk of permanent closure due to staffing. And these are small businesses. These aren't major corporations, you know, typically. These are privately owned small businesses in your district that are being impacted by this. And there are some policy opportunities for us that I think we can use to streamline and at least not make it quite so hard for the providers, with program standards, aligning those, simplifying corrective action processes so they're not jumping through multiple hoops for the same issues. The other issue we're finding now is our economy is truly evolving. We're all seeing changes in wages, and the school readiness program is not adjusting. It's based on federal poverty level. it's not adjusting. Florida's economy is growing, and we need to make sure that our programs align to the changing dynamics here in Florida so that the income eligibility, the access to care aligns with that so that our families can continue to receive the support they need so they can remain in the workforce and ultimately our children can have that quality early learning experience to be on a trajectory for success as they enter kindergarten. I'll stop there and wait for questions.
Thank you. Fantastic. Thank you, Ms. Carson. All right, members. Representative Learned, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you. My question is for Mr. Kiesler first, but if anybody else wants to weigh in on this. And the reason is because you were saying that the percentage of your students is much higher on the private pay, which is similar to my tutoring center. And with the imposition of a new assessment on kids coming out of the program, I heard what you said, and frankly, I heard from all of you, I think, was that we need to really weigh the social and emotional parts, but that doesn't seem to be assessed based on the chancellor's testimony that we need to be able to do our assessment on an iPad. So how does that impact your private pay students and your business model with them?
You recognize, Mr. Keister.
Thank you, Chair. If we don't test or assess or monitor the right things, I believe you have quality centers that will say, we're done. We're not gonna serve those kids. Because what happens is, first of all, let me explain something. We need to be held accountable. You should hold us accountable. But you should hold us accountable by the right measures. And if we just focus, I hear sometimes that, well, all four-year-olds should be able to read when they leave. It's not developmentally appropriate. Some will, some won't. But that shouldn't be the measure of success. We need to also look at what learning gains are. When a child comes to us, where are they at when they start and where are they at when they finish needs to be a huge measure of how well that center or that business is operating and serving those children and those families. The other piece is when we talk about the mix, we will look at our previous readiness results. And I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody, but when you look at the children that have been with us for 4 years or have full day wraparound care, their scores are higher than the children that just come to us for 3 hours a day. So, you have to look at those, because then if your rates start dropping from a perspective like you talked about, those private pay parents might say, well, why is your score like that? And it's not because it's how we're running the system, not how we're providing the service. Does that answer your question?
It does, and I think just as a follow-up to one of the centers that has a higher percent, I know the Miami one, you were saying you're 96%, so obviously you're much more, you have to meet the standard, right? So how does that impact your business?
You're recognized.
In addition to the class assessment scores, employee performance, we have the assessment scores. So everything for Excel is leveraged on performance of the teacher, program, and the student. And without that being, all three of those being successful daily and annually, because the teacher performance is daily, they do one thing that calls a class one, my business is closed. And I mean, I am the highest ranked quality center in my zip code. And I don't sleep at night because of the regulations and how stringent they are. And that staff member can go across the street and continue to work.
Ranking member, go ahead, Ms. Weifel. Ranking Member Davis, you recognized for a question?
Caught me off guard. Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I wanted to go back really quickly to Ms. Carson. All we really have heard is the social-emotional learning. We definitely have heard about the shortage, and we've heard a lot about the cost it is to your staff. And because we've returned to listen to the shortages that are in our healthcare system, I definitely do not want this conversation to not include the shortages we have in our VPK centers as well as our educators, period, going into our schools. So just want that to be highlighted. But I did want to go back to Ms. Carson, because you stopped with some policy assists, because like our chair said, we're not the appropriation, and we know that's what this is somewhat all about. But could you continue with the policy assists? You started with the Simplify Corrective Actions, programming's aligned with the demands and the growth of the area. But could you continue for us really quickly?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Absolutely. I was trying to stay on my timing there.
Appreciated.
There are some things. So, for example, you know, our providers, they've talked about the red tape and some of the additional requirements that they have to contend with. When they apply for a school readiness contract, they have to submit a series of documents. Then they have to go to licensing and submit background screenings, credential information. Then they apply for a VPK program and have to submit the same documents again for the purposes of the VPK program. So we have staff who are looking at background screenings, credentials. At the same time, somebody at DCF is over there looking at the same background screenings and credential, assuming we get them in a timely manner. Why can't we just have the provider submit it one time, streamline the system, so that at least it's one less headache? It doesn't fix the staffing issue, but it takes one step away from that issue. When they're on a corrective action plan for VPK, and we are working toward alignment and great partnership with the Division of Early Learning and with the passage of House Bill 419 last year, we are working on some of these alignments, but you can be a school readiness provider and be on a corrective action plan due to a low class score with poor performance on teacher-child interaction, and there's nothing happening in your VPK program, or perhaps your VPK program is on probation, but you're working a separate parallel corrective action plan in the VPK program. So if we can consolidate those, it allows us to maximize resources, most importantly, to support the providers in making the necessary improvements to their programs.
Vice Chair Costa, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and I'm going to shift to what I think all of you have suggested is one of the major issues you're seeing, and that's workforce. And the question's really for any of you that want to address it, because all of you touched on it. And, you know, I'm curious, the Chancellor has talked to us about shifting the narrative, and in my mind, the narrative is such a huge part of this. You know, I personally had the narrative, you know, with my own children when I started having children, of the daycare. You know, I don't want to send my kids to daycare. I should be raising my kids, right? And quickly learned that it's really not daycare, it's early learning. And that narrative has shifted in my mind, and I think we've seen that narrative shifting throughout the state from daycare to early learning. So now we have this other narrative that the Chancellor's talked to us about, which is these people looking for a job versus being an early learning professional. So how, if any of you have any ideas on how, if there's a policy change or if there's something that we could be doing in our districts to help shift that narrative from a job to an early learning professional, if any of you have thoughts on that, I'd love to hear them.
I can call on someone. Mr. Keister.
Thank you. I think it's, part of it is going to be, I think we've got to start, and I think one of the presenters talked about we've got to start in high school. You know, we have a high school here in Leon County that has a early childhood program. We need to start showing those career paths earlier to people that love the passion of teaching. So I think we got to start earlier. We got to hit our high schools. We got to hit our community colleges. I think also creating incentives for the workforce to enter. You know, I know we have, it's not throughout the state, but there's, it used to be called wages, now it's called incentives. But an incentives program that motivates teachers that as they get continuing education, there's a reward in it. And the reward in it for them is compensation. Plus, then what happens is what we're trying to do here locally is build a relationship with our feeder K-12 schools. The biggest challenge, like we say, what we're finding now is we're losing some of our teachers to the public school system. because they're having the same problems we're having. Well, I've had some conversations with our superintendent. If we can create kind of a funnel where if we could get some teachers and we can keep them for a year or two and we train them in early learning, and that creates a funnel for the K-12 system, and then we recite, we keep going that, it's a win-win for everybody. So those are some ideas.
Anyone else on the panel like to comment? Ms. Carson?
I would just add that I think there's opportunity for apprenticeship programs, taking them through that pipeline from the high school, but looking at the ability to bring them through apprenticeship programs. And I say that because training is not enough. Oftentimes when we hear about issues with our workforce, we get the response, well, we should make a training for that. We need someone to come to the training. So we have to encourage them. But building on the idea of professionalizing our field, rather than going to some clock hour trainings, they're great, but not enough, going to some clock hour trainings, instead going through a comprehensive apprenticeship program that is coupled with coaching. Just doing a training, I have to do driving school. I can tell you it's not the same as having someone, you know, sit next to you and teach you. The coaching that is helping them to implement those practices is going to assist in keeping them in the field because they're supported. They're not just tossed in a classroom and hoping, but they're actually professionals who are being trained on a career, and I think we could take advantage of some of those programs.
Representative Caruso, you're recognized with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank each and every one of you for your service to our state, our communities, and most importantly, our children. Clearly, your dedication and your passion is so evident. And the struggles that you put forth are very enlightening and eye-opening. I raised 7 kids, and they all went through a VPK program right down the street from us. The woman in charge, it changed their lives. I mean, it's life-changing, and it's amazing what you do. And it's sad to hear the struggles you're having. And I'm kind of overwhelmed by it. Ms. Pointville, you mentioned one thing where the teachers, if they did something wrong, keeps you up at night, then you get punished, even something out of your control. They could have had a bad night at home, fight with their husband or wife, and kids kept her up all night, or newborn child, and your teacher comes in and snaps at one of your kids, and you could be shut down. And I just want to point out that's a serious issue. A serious concern of mine that a great, you know, operation like yours could be shut down for something totally out of your control, something out of anybody's control. And we need to work towards changing that. I want you all to know that your presence here today is not for naught. We hear you loud and clear, at least I do. And I hope I can speak for, see some of the other heads shaking. So, just want to say thank you. One question I can throw out there: What is the average salary of a starting teacher, and the average salary overall?
You recognize Ms. Pointville.
Thank you. $12 an hour, and that's when you're sustainable in childcare. Typically, it's minimum wage, and we push for 10, but to beat out the neighboring schools, I go for $12 to $14 an hour.
You recognize?
Ms. Hitchcock.
Ms. Hitchcock.
Yes, I agree with her. It's about that you have to be competitive because the lack of teachers that are available to us, you need to try to get them into you, and sometimes that costs more. And then your girls that have been with you 15 and 20 years, you have to appreciate and validate their time with you by continuing to move them up. And for some of these young ladies, I tell them, you know, I've been doing business longer than you've been alive. So I need, you know, these are people's children. It's not like a burger. You mess it up, you can fix it. These are people's children. And what you do can affect them their entire lives. So it's a very serious thing.
Representative Roach, you're recognized with a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This has been instructive and enlightening. And, you know, one of the challenges about getting elected, we're all up here, we're all some of our experiences. My professional experience has been driving boats and chasing smugglers on the high seas. I am not an educator. I have no experience in early learning or childhood education. So this perspective, this boots on the ground experiential perspective is very important. It makes a difference. So I appreciate your very thoughtful responses. And with that said, as those of us that have been elected to craft statewide policy on early learning, I'd like to just ask you if there's any parting shot, anything else that you think we should know, any question we haven't asked, any pearls of wisdom you want to impart on this body as we move forward in this session to make policy. And thank you again for your time.
So in the interest of time, we have 3 minutes. We can run down and everyone can give their 30-second, yeah.
Thank you, man. Thank you, Chair. I'm being in working parallel with budgeting, so the demands and expectations and regulations set be in alignment with the funds that are available for us to deliver sustainably and consistently. The extra dollar here of 25 cent there causes my staff to fall over a, what is it called, the cliff, where they're like, Ms. Pointville, if you can't put me in a position to thrive, leave my salary here, because my rent, my social services, my medication is all increasing every time you give me a little bit extra. What I appreciate the effort that you're making, but I don't go any further because I can't afford my medicine.
Mr. Keister.
Thank you, Chair. Words matter. And, you know, we have a lot of chiefs. We have DCF, we have DOE, we have DEL, we have ELCs, we have accrediting bodies, we have Department of Health, we have Fire Marshal. We have a lot of chiefs. So our job is hard on everything we have to balance. And when I say words matter, the important job that you have is creating law for regulatory bodies to create rule for. And an example I will use is in statute 402305, the rule says you have to have a minimum of one person on site at all times with health, with CPR and first aid. DCF a little while ago tried to interpret that from 1 to 100. So words do matter. So when you're drafting that, make sure it's clear what your expectations are. And then the last thing is ultimately parents decide what quality is for their children. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keister. Ms. Hitchcock.
Again, we thank you. I can't imagine your job. Mine seems so much more fun.
Now it's like playing with kids up here too.
That's right. We're just, you know, we're changing the world one child at a time. And it starts at infancy, and we appreciate all that you do. And there are lots of regulatories, and for some of us, we even fall under DEP if you're on a well, and that's a whole nother place. But we thank you and the coalitions that support us, the families that support us. We want to be there for them, and we don't know what the future holds with COVID and everything going forward, but we thank you for listening to us, and it's amazing that it's across the state. It's like we're in the same building.
Thank you. Ms. Carson, you have the benediction.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here again. I think as a takeaway, I would remind everyone that providers are trying. They are doing their very best with limited resources. And oftentimes there are discussions of, well, how can we attract better providers to come into this neighborhood? And in reality, we have providers who have been doing this work for 10, 20, 40 years in communities. They may have struggled, but they've been doing it. I would not contend that we lower standards, that we reduce the quality expectations for our providers, but as you are pursuing and looking at how you can affect policy, I would encourage you to keep the bar high. Let's set the bar, but provide the necessary resources, and I know there's money there, but still the necessary resources and support through the coaching, through the incentives, through the reforms that allow those providers who in good faith are trying to do the very best, to to achieve what we all agree that we want to see in terms of maximum quality for students' success, they will rise to the occasion with the necessary resources and with the support. And for those who don't rise to the occasion, maybe there's something else they will pursue. But most of our providers are in it for the right reason, and they are willing and able to do the work with the support.
Thank you so much, Ms. Carson. Members, I would just say this. I hope that this was as enlightening to the reality of early learning as my conversations with so many of you over the last few months has been. That's why I wanted to have this meeting, because I think so few people really understand what's going on. And I'll just say this, when we have 10 seconds left, words do matter. That's why it's not daycare, it's early learning. That's why they're not childcare workers, they're teachers. But again, to each and every one of you for driving and being here, thank you so much. We really appreciate it. And seeing no further business with that, Representative Roach moves we rise.